Hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
May be seated. Morning, counsel. You will note that the two chairs to my left are there, but the justices aren't. Chief Justice Abramson will not be participating in this case, nor will Justice John Wilcox. So we will call the first case for today's argument. It's DigiCorp versus Ameritech Corporation, case number 01-1833 and 01-2258. I have 20 minutes for Mr. Affel. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor.
25 minutes? 20 minutes for Victor Plantinga. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Yes.
Then 10 minutes for Gregory Cook. And then another 5 minutes response from counsel. Very good. You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my
name.
It's
a busy week for you.
Yes, Your Honor. This was originally scheduled to be heard last Wednesday, and that would have been a much busier time for me. May it please the court, my name is Mike Apfeld, and I represent Ameritech Corporation. Ameritech has been held liable to DigiCorp and Bakker for failing to disclose what it supposedly knew about a certain Dan Krinsky. As you will recall, it was this Krinsky who forged literally hundreds of customer contracts while in the employ of Bakker and while DigiCorp's so-called 1099 employee. Now, before turning to the several compelling issues this case presents, it is important to emphasize three critical facts. First, DigiCorp had a written distributorship agreement with Ameritech long before the Krinsky episode. Second, Krinsky, the real villain in this story, approached Bakker. Bakker hired Krinsky and approached DigiCorp. They entered into an agreement, and Krinsky began selling, that is, forging, these contracts well before DigiCorp first asked Ameritech about Krinsky. And third, although it was clearly DigiCorp's and Bakker's duty to supervise Krinsky, neither so much as looked at Krinsky's contracts until Ameritech alerted them that something was amiss. And when they finally did look, the forgeries were immediately apparent. Now, despite their overwhelming contributions to both their own and to Ameritech's losses, Bakker and DigiCorp have escaped all accountability by the simple expedient of pleading fraud. It's allowed them to circumvent their own neglect of duty. It's allowed them to recover expectation damages unfettered by the limitations of the contract itself. And it has allowed DigiCorp, at least, to recover punitive damages for what was, we will see, at worst, the failure to fulfill a contractual undertaking. Now, in our briefs, we have set forth a series of reasons why the economic loss doctrine should be either defined or applied to prohibit tort recovery in this case. And I'd like to go through those. And I'll begin with what I believe is the logically first argument, and that is that there simply should not be an exception for fraud in the economic loss doctrine. Now, in making this argument, in considering this argument, I think it is important to consider what we are not arguing. We are not arguing that there should be no remedy for fraud. We are arguing that there should be no tort remedy for fraud. And I think that when you look at things, you will see that both the policies behind the economic loss doctrine extend equally to fraud cases, and that, in fact, there is still an adequate remedy viewed in the perspective of contract law for misrepresentations, particularly the sort of misrepresentations contained in this case. Now, let's take a look at those policies, if you will. The first policy that this Court has articulated in support of the economic loss doctrine is to maintain the distinction between contract and tort law. This case, I would submit, presents an extremely good example of just how easily that line can be blurred. Now, in this case, by contract, responsibility for approval and certification of Krinsky, as well as for his supervision, was assigned by contract. the alleged misrepresentation related exclusively to that subject matter. Let's actually take a look at that alleged misrepresentation. What is supposed to have happened? Mr. Clark of DigiCorp says he went to Mr. Taylor of Ameritech and said, what do you know about Krinsky? And what did Mr. Taylor say? He said, Krinsky's not in my territory. That's true. I don't know anything about it, him. They claim that's false. But I'll check into it. And he said this in the course of a conversation in which he also was describing Ameritech's requirement that these 1099 employees be approved and certified, a requirement which Mr. Clark testified he understood to be that Ameritech would search its entire body of knowledge in approving and certifying this person. So what do we have there? If Mr. Taylor misrepresented his knowledge of Krinsky, there is no conceivable way that that could be relied upon, because it's one man talking about someone who's not in his territory. The only reliance here could possibly have been on the representation that I will check into it and the representation that he will be certified and approved. And what are those representations? They're in the nature of promises. That's what they are. The real complaint here is that Ameritech supposedly failed to disclose in the course of this whole proceedings what its promises were. And finally, the damages here, there's no question that they are purely economic. Yet by attaching the label fraud to this episode, the plaintiffs were essentially allowed to play out this little morality play. Now let's look at the second policy behind the economic loss doctrine: to protect commercial parties' freedom to allocate risk. Let's look at the effects of allowing a claim here on that contractual allocation of risk.
Let me interrupt you, if I might, for a couple minutes. I thought the Court of Appeals in their decision in this case put forth some very good public policy reasons why there should be a fraud exception. Let's just assume for a minute that the Court of Appeals is correct, that there ought to be some fraud exception.
Yes, sir.
The way I read your brief, you seem to then argue that if we were going to adopt a fraud exception, it should be more narrow than the Court of Appeals fraud exception, and that it should be based on the Huron Tool case. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, would you tell us briefly what you think the Huron Tool case says, what it stands for?
Yes. If I might, in beginning that, I think that I would caution Your Honors that if you look at the cases that are out there, there is sometimes some terminological disagreements. It seems, though, that when you look at these cases, the Huron Tool cases and the cases which allow a limitless exception, they're all talking about fraud in the inducement, not fraud in the performance. We have yet to see a case that allows a tort claim for fraud in the performance of a contract, and I believe that Kalin versus Armstrong from our Court of Appeals has held that that's not available. Anyway, the Huron Tool exception draws a distinction between misrepresentations which are interwoven with the contract and those which are extraneous to the contract. In this respect, I believe that if you are going to adopt some sort of fraud exception, that this limited version of the exception is most consistent with the policies underlying the economic loss doctrine, because it encourages the parties to assess the risk and to allocate the risk in the contracting process. It's also consistent with the rule that has been enunciated by this court and our courts of appeals for quite a number of years. The rule is traceable to a case called Landwehr versus Citizens Trust that basically says where the sole source of a duty is the contract, you can't turn it into a tort. You have a contract remedy. Now, There have been assertions in the briefs of the opponents as well as in the brief of the amicus that this is an uncontrollable exception, that it will swallow the it's the exception that swallows the rule, as it were. And it is true that the cases that Huron Tool itself and the cases that apply it, I don't know if they have yet fixed on a single linguistic formulation of the rule. But if I would suggest to this Court that really a fairly conservative formulation of the rule, which is consistent with the intent, and when I say conservative, I mean it actually preserves a broader range of tort remedies for fraud, that the rule would be as follows. Tort remedies are not available for fraud in the inducement where the essential elements of the alleged misrepresentation are substantially embodied in or covered by the agreement.
Now, let's look at your formulation for a minute. How do you see the contract, the agreement here, as being interwoven? Obviously, you take the position that it is.
Yes.
With the fraud in the inducement claim. And obviously, your opponent says, no, it's extraneous. Why do you think it's interwoven? What can you point to in the contract that would show that it's interwoven?
Mm-hmm. Well, Your Honor, I've already mentioned to you that, how this, well, the instance in which this fraud, the supposed fraud first took place. That is, Mr. Clark said to Mr. Taylor, what do you know? And Mr. Taylor says, he's not in my territory. I don't know anything about him, but I will check. And he says this in the same context as a discussion of Ameritech requirements of certification and approval. Mr. Clark also testifies how he understands, what he understands that certification and approval to be, and it in fact is an extension of Taylor's suggestion that it will be checked on. The approval and certification language appears then in an April 30th letter confirming the terms under which they may use the 1099 employees. That, in turn, is cross-referenced in the agreement itself. I believe it is paragraph 6.3 that actually obligates the parties to follow the policies and practices of Ameritech, which the April 30th letter clearly is. And I believe paragraph 1.3 of that agreement also refers to the certification process. The letter was also expressly incorporated into the Bakker DigiCorp contract as well. Then, immediately after that letter goes out, DigiCorp, as part of the certification process, sends to Ameritech a list of the employees for the precise purpose of having them certified and approved. Silence emanates after that. But eventually, Mr. Clark testifies that he followed up, that Mr. Taylor said he would eventually approve of it, he would check up on it. And eventually he says, what happened to the paperwork? And Mr. Taylor says, don't worry, it all went through. This is all part and parcel, the misrepresentation and the contractual process of certification and approval is really part and parcel of the same transaction. It is interwoven, as you will. In addition to that, of course.
Well, if it is.
Yes.
And assuming for the moment that it is, that then at least creates another argument that maybe we've got to go back to the initial issue, which is whether there should be an exception. And so your argument that the second, which you didn't get a chance to go on to, was the freedom to allocate risk. How can you, if there is these kind of misrepresentations in the inducement to contract, in other words, without those misrepresentations, a contract may never have existed.
Yes.
How can you say then that the parties were free to allocate risks when they weren't on the same playing field? One knew something that the other one should have known.
Yes. Well, a couple of responses to that. First, Your Honor, there has been some language about, well, you can't assess the risk of the other party lying. Rarely have I been accused of speaking too softly.
Or slowly, yeah.
To address, Your Honor, parties, when they are allocating risk, they allocate the risk not of lying per se, but of accuracy or inaccuracy, of performance or of non-performance. So it is possible to allocate that risk, not so much saying, "Oh, I'm allocating the risk that he's lying." You just allocate the risk that he's either wrong or that he won't perform the way that he says he will perform. And the likelihood of the performance is one component of that allocation. But another component of that allocation is, how much is it going to hurt if it proves to be false or does not come to pass?
Well, I enter into a contract with a life insurance.
Yes.
And I don't disclose the fact that I've got cancer, I got a prostate. Mm-hmm. And then later on die of that.
Yes.
I mean, the insurance company will be in this court hollering.
They
will.
That,
hey, we were not free to allocate that risk because we didn't know of the risk. And isn't that precisely what DigiCorp is saying in this case? We didn't know of the risk. Therefore, since we didn't know, we couldn't allocate.
Well, let's pass aside for a moment the credibility of that allegation, and I'll accept your question on its premise. The insurance company, for example, yes, they would have grounds to complain, and they would, in fact, have a remedy against your state for rescission. They don't have to sue it in tort. Let's turn to what the remedies are here. I mean, in fact, one of the available remedies was not only pleaded and submitted to the jury, but DigiCorp was awarded damages on that theory, and that is breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, which is well established in contract. They might have pleaded it as a breach of an express covenant because the duty to certify and approve is written there in black and white, and they've pleaded it as an element not only of their contract claim but all of the other claims. I mentioned you could get rescission or restitution. There could be other implied duties as well. You could have spun this one as a breach of the duty of no hindrance. If you look beyond that to other cases, beyond our facts and look to other cases, there are other duties that the law implies. For example, in every duty for the provision of services, there is a duty of certainly good faith, but there's also a duty of good and workmanlike performance and all that. There is, in fact, I don't see any reason why any duty that this court can create under the rubric of tort law cannot also be created under the aegis of contract law.
Because I don't want to interrupt you, though. I thought you were done.
No, go ahead, Your Honor.
Let me follow up on Justice Babbage's question by pointing to what the trial court said here is quoted in the Court of Appeals. It says, one, and this is paragraph 39 of the Court of Appeals opinion, one who acts fraudulently prevents the parties from freely allocating risk by deceiving the other party about the nature of the risk that is being allocated or even creating the risk after the contract is entered into. It's inimical to the very kind of good faith bargaining that should take place between contracting parties and that the economic loss doctrine is intended to further and protect.
Yes.
Any response to that, or is you just incorporate what you said in response to Justice Babbage?
Well, I think that the answer is if the playing field has been tilted so much that it destroys the ability of the parties to reach a fair allocation of risk, then contract law provides a remedy, and that is rescission and restitution and other remedies which are consistent with contract law. And what we're talking about here is the entire contractual framework, the relationship of these parties and their duties to one another. And that, incidentally, then leads to yet another one of the arguments that we have made.
Before you get to the other argument, the Court of Appeals then says there are policy reasons for allowing this fraud in the inducement exception. I mean, your response is, well, look, they have if they were naughty, then you can get contract damages. But the policy reasons I would like you to address. That says there are policy reasons why a party engaging in fraud should not be able to avail itself of the protections of the economic loss doctrine. Wisconsin, this is the policy reason. Wisconsin has long recognized that parties need a background of truth and fair dealing in their commercial relationship. How does your position advance that policy?
Contract law requires a background of truth and fair dealing in contract relationships. Tort law does not add anything to this except a larger measure of, a more unfettered measure of compensatory damages and punitive damages. That's what it adds. And I would contend that on balance, public policy does not require those, that the inquiry is better addressed in the confines of contract law, examining the contract, not only the obligations of the contract that were allegedly induced by the fraud, but the obligations between the parties that could not conceivably be argued to be induced by fraud, of which there are many in this case. And that leads to another one of our arguments, which is that even if you accept a limitless or essentially limitless exception for fraud in the inducement, the fundamental contractual provisions here were not induced by fraud. If you look at the...
But the jury disagreed with that.
Well, no, not exactly right. The jury found reliance. It did not find that the contract itself was induced by fraud. There could be...
Like two sides of the same coin.
No, I don't think
different
so.
Different sides of the same coin.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because... The facts are that this was a routine renewal of a pre-existing contract, and those facts are set out. But let's assume for a moment that the June 1st, 1996 contract was induced by fraud. Well, as we set forth in our brief, when a replacement contract is induced by fraud, well, what happens? It goes up in smoke, but the pre-existing contract is essentially revivified. You still have a contractual relationship between the parties. And what does that mean? It has two effects. Not only do you still have the same predicate for the economic loss doctrine, but you then have to say, well, where can you point to in that contract that gives you this right to expectation damages? And as we've set forth, they haven't proved any such right to expectation damages under that pre-existing contract either.
Mr. Affleck, let's discuss public policy for a moment. You say that they have adequate remedies, rescission, restitution, et cetera, but they have those remedies even in the absence of fraud. And so as a matter, at least posit to you a devil's advocate argument here, in the absence of fraud, that's very understandable, but shouldn't fraud in the inducement to contract pay a heavier burden than the normal contract damages? Why isn't that good public policy?
Your Honor, there are two reasons, of course, for punitive damages. One is simply vindication, vengeance, as it were, and the other is deterrence. With respect to vindication or vengeance, I would simply argue that the public interest in that is outweighed by the public interest of compelling parties to spend their efforts defining their rights at the inception of the relationship rather than waiting until years after the fact to attempt to reconstruct extra contractual expectations and representations. With regard to the other, deterrence, I would submit that it is vastly overstated. I think that as a matter of fact, someone who is truly intends to defraud someone doesn't expect to get caught, and that the force of the deterrence argument in this respect is probably, and I get into this topic with great hesitation, but probably no greater than that in the discussion about the death penalty. And many people will tell you that doesn't deter at all. But I would also point out, Your Honors, that in at least two separate instances, this Court has essentially rejected that kind of logic. You have, for example, this Court has never accepted the tort of bad faith outside the insurance context, in which, you know, there's a fiduciary relationship that actually forms the predicate for that tort. And it is a longstanding rule, traced back to, I believe, the 19th century, that punitive damages are not recoverable for breach of contract, no matter how egregious the breach. So I think that the Court has recognized that even deterrence, you know, is a public policy with a limited aspect. There are limitations to that, and I think that the policies behind the economic loss doctrine simply outweigh that policy in this sort of a situation, this sort of a situation being contracting parties, arm's length, purely economic damages, and adequate contractual remedies. The one other argument that I would like that we have that I would like to mention is that, everything aside, if you are going to apply a fraud exception to the economic loss doctrine, you must apply it consistent with its internal premise, that is, that the contract itself is void. And here we have parties who were allowed to avoid the contract, as it were, because that's what you have to do to avail yourself of the fraud exception, but recover expectation damages. And that is not consistent. That cannot be sustained. And for that reason as well, you know, we think that the judgment should be reversed.
I do have a question about that measure of damages issue. I found the damages awards in this case to be odd. We've got a number for the misrepresentation in favor of DigiCorp of $254,926.83. And I haven't gone back to look at the record to find out what record support there is for that very precise number. But what instructions were given to the jury and what evidence was given to the jury on the measure of damages here?
May I answer this question, Your Honor?
Yes.
I cannot explain how that number was derived at. The instructions consisted largely of standard instructions for the recovery of damages. They clearly encompass, you're speaking specifically to Baca, they clearly encompass loss of expectation damages, because that's the only sort of damages that the DigiCorp submitted. The one significant difference in the instructions, and this is a difference between the bad faith instruction and the instruction for tort, for fraud, is that the Court advised the jury in the bad faith argument that in calculating the expectation damages, or the damages that they might calculate, that the jury was entitled to take into consideration the limitations of the contract, which we must assume that they did. And that's why the bad faith award, which presumably the jury took into consideration the limited nature of this contract, is $13,000. How they arrived at that other figure, I do not know.
I have one other question.
Mr. Prosser has a question.
The $100,000 in damages that was awarded to Bacher, are those tort damages or contract damages?
Well, they were clearly awarded for a tort claim. There are several components of those at which we took issue in the Court of Appeals. Ultimately, the Court of Appeals justified the entire $100,000 award on the basis of testimony that conservatively estimated Bacher had incurred $10,000 of damage to business reputation. What is damage to business reputation? Well, in the context of this case, they could be damaged in two ways. First, they could be damaged because the public found out they had hired a fraud. And the second, they could be damaged because the public found out that they no longer could sub-market Ameritech products. Well, with regard to the first component, they had hired a fraud long before the alleged, you know, Ameritech's alleged problem here. And with regard to the second component, that's expectation damages.
I guess what I really am anxious to get at is, Why is there no balancing of that with Bakker's own contribution to their problems? Is it an intentional tort versus
yes.
negligence?
Contributory negligence is no defense to an intentional tort. And so we are faced with the gross neglect of duties from long before the alleged fraud. We're essentially defenseless against it.
Justice Savage?
Bradley?
One additional question, if I may.
Yeah.
Just for clarification, I know that in the Court of Appeals, the issue of the amount of damages was before the court and addressed by the court. As I understand the issues before this court here today, that the amount of damages is not in issue, rather entitlement to the type of damages, theory of liability, et cetera, is in issue. Am I wrong or am I correct?
That's a fair characterization, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Any other questions? You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Plantinga, representing DigiCorp.
Yes. May it please the court, my name is Victor Plantinga, and I'm here on behalf of DigiCorp. This case involved fraud in the inducement of a contract, where the conduct that preceded the inception of that contract was so egregious that the jury awarded punitive damages. On two occasions prior to the June 1st, 1996 contract, Stuart Clark asked Ray Taylor what he knew about Dan Krinsky. At that time, as the jury found, Taylor knew that Dan Krinsky, in his previous employment, had forged customer signatures on contracts, which is essentially a criminal act. Taylor knew that Krinsky had committed crimes in the context of his previous position. Clark asked that question of Taylor twice, and both times Taylor lied to him, said he didn't know anything about Krinsky. Krinsky wasn't in his territory. Instead of telling the truth, he concealed that fact from Mr. Clark. And then Mr. Clark, on behalf of DigiCorp, went ahead with the June 1st contract, which is before the court.
Is there any evidence that, but for that misrepresentation, DigiCorp would not have renewed with Ameritech?
Well, what we have, Your Honor, is this June 1st contract was different than the contract that was previously in existence between the two parties. The available evidence was that the previous contract did not give Ameritech the right to terminate without notice DigiCorp's distributorship upon the submission of one fraudulent contract.
What were the termination provisions of the pre-existing contract? And was there an expiration date on that contract, or was it perpetual until renewed or supplanted by another?
Those facts were not in the record, other than there was no anti-slamming provision of the previous contract. We do know that in the June 1st contract, Ameritech had various termination clauses. One was 30 days for cause, and then they had this new provision that allowed Ameritech to terminate with no notice, and they don't even have to prove that the contract was fraudulent. They could simply have a customer say, I didn't sign it, and that would be enough for Ameritech to, by the contract, terminate Ameritech's DigiCorp's distributorship.
I'm going to restate my earlier question then. Is there any evidence in the record that, but for Taylor's misrepresentations, DigiCorp would not have renewed, would not have entered into that contract?
I don't know if there's evidence of that, but...
And don't we have a failure of proof on detrimental reliance? Setting aside the legal question about
sure.
whether we should adopt a fraud exception to the economic loss doctrine.
The jury...
Is there a complete failure of proof on that?
I'm sorry. The jury did find and actually asked of the trial court, is it necessary that we find both an intent to induce and an intent to defraud, an intent to induce conduct and an intent to defraud, and the court Judge Griesbach said, yes, you have to find both.
I'm asking about evidence of DigiCorp's detrimental reliance.
Yes.
Change of position in reliance on the misrepresentation. Is there any evidence to support the proposition that but for those misrepresentations, DigiCorp would not have renewed?
Stuart Clark did testify that had he been told about Krinsky's fraud, criminal activity in the past, he would not have gone ahead with this such that he placed his own distributorship at risk. And the June 1st contract memorialized Ameritech's power to terminate that distributorship.
He testified that he would not have entered into the June 1st contract?
He testified that he would not have hired or allowed Krinsky to be selling under his distributorship.
That's something different, though.
Okay.
We're talking, I'm having a lot of trouble with the legal theories here and whether there's any evidentiary support. And the contract that was supposedly fraudulently induced is the June 1st, 1996 distributorship agreement.
That's correct.
Which was a renewal of a pre-existing agreement. We don't know whether it was or was not less favorable to DigiCorp. All we know from the record is that it included this termination without notice for the slamming. Right?
That's correct.
But we don't know what the termination provisions were under the old contract, right?
Only that they did not include the termination for slamming, but you are correct, Your Honor.
Right. I mean, the old contract may have included a provision that allowed termination under some other language, right?
That's possible.
It's just not in evidence.
From the available record, that's correct.
Right. And we don't have any testimony that but for the misrepresentations of Taylor, DigiCorp would not have renewed with Ameritech as a distributor or that that prior contract would have terminated. We don't have any testimony about that either. So there is a failure of proof on detrimental reliance.
Well, I think the question is that the jury was specifically asked to find reliance, and they did find reliance, and in addition...
But if there isn't any proof to support that finding, then even if we decide the legal question in your favor, you lose.
I don't believe that's correct, because we do know that he asked Stuart Clark, asked Ray Taylor, Ameritech's Ray Taylor, prior to going ahead with this arrangement where Krinsky would be selling under his license.
But that's not what was fraudulently induced. The legal theory here is that the June 1st contract between DigiCorp and Ameritech was fraudulently induced, not that the contract between DigiCorp and Bakker was fraudulently induced by Taylor's misrepresentation.
That's correct. The June 1st contract is, in fact, the contract that's at issue here.
Okay.
And the evidence was that that June 1st contract contained provisions that were different from the previous one. The available evidence in the record is that it contained an anti-slamming provision that was not found in the previous one.
Right, but there is no evidence that DigiCorp would not have entered into that contract but for the misrepresentations. He wasn't asked.
He wasn't asked that question, but, Your Honor, if I could talk a little bit about the freedom to allocate risk, which is, of course, an important part of whether this economic loss doctrine is extended or not. I do not think it's fair that the court would focus on the terms of the June 1st contract when clearly the conduct that precipitated the June 1st contract was, in fact, fraud that allowed this relationship to go forward and memorialize those terms in the June 1st contract. Mr. Clark asked on two occasions about the prior knowledge of Dan Krinsky, about his what he knew about Mr. Krinsky's prior employment. On two occasions, he was lied to. He was told by Mr. Taylor that he did not know of Dan Krinsky. Ameritech repeatedly argued that Krinsky was not an Ameritech employee. So therefore, it would make sense in Mr. Clark's mind that Taylor would not have known anything about Krinsky, when in fact he did. And not only did he know about Krinsky, he knew that Krinsky had engaged in essentially criminal conduct at his prior prior employment. The very type of conduct that if he did it under this new arrangement going forward would put DigiCorp's distributorship at risk. When you talk about freedom to allocate, our Court of Appeals in this case talked about a level playing field. It said there is no freedom to allocate risk when one side is being untruthful, concealing information from the other side that would allow them to assess that risk and allocate that risk in the contract.
Counsel, let me interrupt at this point and ask you what I asked your opposing counsel earlier. You've indicated in your brief, as I read your brief, that even if this court were to accept the Huron Tool exception, that everything is extraneous to the contract. And yet just a couple minutes ago when you were answering questions from Justice Sykes, you were talking about the termination provisions and how those termination provisions were tied to any possibility of forged signatures. Now, that strikes me as not being extraneous to the contract at issue. So tell me why you think that what went on here is extraneous to the issues involved here. Okay. The letter also was referred to by your opposing counsel, and maybe you could address that as well.
Sure. This contract really covered the lakefront as far as the breadth of it. It covered territory, distributor duties, trademarks, confidentiality, commissions, products. It was not simply DigiCorp buying a single product from Ameritech. The heart of the agreement and the cases adopting Huron Tool, the Florida cases, talk about what is the heart of the agreement. The heart of the agreement was that DigiCorp would be selling Ameritech services, including Intralata services. There is no contention that the services provided by Ameritech, these telephone services, were in any way deficient. And when you talk about the Huron Tool exception, if you look into the Huron case itself, it is, first of all, it's a goods case, and this is the services. But even if you were to apply economic loss doctrine to both goods and services, it's a very limited exception, and it talks about the quality and character of goods. It says where the issue concerning the representation is the quality and character of goods, that under those circumstances, the parties are free to allocate risk in the contract. The question that we have here is a representation about Ameritech's knowledge. And furthermore, the contract itself, as I said, covers a whole variety of things that were not essentially what they knew or did not know about Dan Krinsky's past. It was, as I said, about telephone services. So the representations were not about the heart of the agreement between the parties. They were extraneous to it.
That seems like an awfully thin line to walk. You can walk that and you can make it and articulate the argument quite well, like you just did. Mm-hmm. But I'm still left with the sense that how do you define, you know, what's the heart of the agreement? What's the quality and character of the goods? I mean, I understand you're saying
yes.
The value pack or whatever value call is the service that they were selling, and we're talking about misrepresentation. I'm just wondering if the Huron exception essentially eliminates the core of fraud in the inducement and why it was the policy behind its creation. But you're not taking that position. Hmm?
Well, I think Huron Tool is basically saying where, and if you look at the Huron Tool exception, it's a computer software system. All right. The Florida cases talk about those types of cases. And, you know, to an extent, Douglas Hanson, the case that came up here, was also about quality and character of goods. Is, in Douglas Hanson, a product ready for market? That is what the parties were contracting for. They were contracting for the sale of goods, and the representation had to do with the goods that were being provided and whether they were of a sufficient quality or character. And under those circumstances, if you follow the Huron Tool exception, they say, well, the parties already agreed in their contract about much of what was the representations that arose from tort liability. And under those limited circumstances, and if you read Huron Tool, it's very limited. I mean, they talk about they say under most circumstances, fraud cases will not be subsumed by Huron Tool, fraud that precedes the contract. But where those issues of character and quality are subsumed in the contract itself, then we're not going to let you go outside for tort remedies. And when you look at the services that were the services end of it, that's the same thing. The Key Largo case, which I cited in my brief, had to do with a licensing agreement for hotels. And they said about training staff, advertising, and so forth, that this was going to be done prior to this licensing agreement going forward. And those very duties were subsumed in the licensing agreement. In this case, the representation had to do with Ameritech's knowledge of Ray Taylor, and of which they lied. It's clearly extraneous to the contract as opposed to the Huron Tool cases, both goods and services, where those very duties are not only interwoven into the contract, but comprise the very heart of the agreement.
Counsel, how do you handle the letter? I asked you earlier and didn't get to that, but how do you handle the letter that went, I think, from Taylor to Clark that specifically talks about the responsibilities in regard to 1099 employees?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that seem to be interwoven with the ultimate June 1st contract?
It does assign responsibility for DigiCorp to be responsible for the actions of Prinsky. The problem that we have, though, in this case, is that the very nature of that risk was misrepresented because of the statements by Taylor where he concealed knowledge from us. In other words, on its face, we had no reason to know about the type and the quality and the extent of the risk that we had going forward in this after the April 30 letter and the June 1st contract, because they misrepresented what they knew. It was a far greater risk than we were able to appreciate. And it wasn't because of a lack of diligence on our part that we didn't appreciate that risk. It was because they had information that they deliberately concealed from us. And I think that is the distinction, Your Honor, that has to be made. Ultimately, under the contract, responsibility for Krinsky was assigned to us, but his being in the position that he was created by their intentional misrepresentation. And on that basis, the economic loss doctrine should not be extended.
As a general matter, why are contract remedies insufficient to deal with fraud that occurs either in the inducement or in the performance of a contract?
Okay.
I understand that in any given case, you know, there might be insufficiencies, but as a general matter, why are contract mm-hmm. remedies insufficient?
There's a couple reasons for this. If you look at this case, and I don't think this distributorship agreement is very different from the run-of-the-mill one in some respects, there is a clause in there that says 30 days, upon 30 days written notice, either party may terminate. All right? And that's what the jury was told when they were assessing a breach of the implied duty of good faith damages. That's why we have, I think, is a $13,000 award, because they were told, look only at that 30-day time frame. When you have a situation like this, this 30-day contract provision, which is seems innocuous on its face, becomes a de facto limitation on damages because it would not have been the entire period of the contract. It would only be the shortest period that's available under the contract, which in this case was the 30 days. For that reason, contract remedies are insufficient because those types of clauses, which are common in many contracts, does very little to deter the conduct that forms the basis for an intentional tort.
Isn't that language negotiable? I mean, can't the parties, when they enter into their contract, negotiate termination terms?
The difficulty, Your Honor, is this, is that to adequately protect yourself in a contract setting, if this Court extends the economic loss doctrine to the point that Ameritech requests, it's going to be incumbent on the contracting parties to say, anticipate what lies are being told them, or series of lies, how will that affect our business going forward? And as the Court knows, liquidated damages provisions are quite rare in contracts. And if they were to apply it in this case, or in a series of cases of business relationships, those liquidated damages provisions would have to be fairly open-ended because you don't know what lies are being told to you. You don't know what series of lies might be told to you, and you also don't know, going forward, what effect that might have on your business. So I think to say that the parties are free to allocate damages in a contract is fine so long as parties are being truthful and the nature of the risk is out there on the table, that, as the Court of Appeals said, that there is a level playing field.
Well, there is a cause of action in contract for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing that is implied in every contract. Is there not?
There is a contract breach of the implied duty of good faith. I don't know that Wisconsin courts have recognized that as strongly as you might say. I think that.
What's the measure of damages for that contract claim?
It would.
Or what's the remedy?
The remedy would be the bargain for damages under the contract.
And so why would that be insufficient?
I think it's insufficient because it's insufficient to punish parties for engaging in fraud. If you have a fraud in the inducement of a contract that causes a party, the other party, to take substantial steps to rely to forego other opportunities when the conduct is so egregious that it is found to be fraud in the inducement, actual fraud, the policy is that there has to be something in addition to contract remedies that would sufficiently punish that type of activity.
Does the McKenzie versus Miller Brewing case have any relevance here? I believe in that case this Court said that there is no cause of action for fraud in the inducement of continued employment. And I recognize this is an independent contractor
sure.
situation, but it's at least analogous, isn't it?
I don't know that it is because there is a the overlay on that case is that you have an employer-employee relationship and you have long-standing principles that allow employers to make administrative decisions regarding how to run their business without court intervention, and that's the whole premise behind the employee at will doctrine. What we have here is we have parties that are commercial parties, and we have a very limited, if you accept that Market Street Associates, the Seventh Circuit opinion, a very limited contractual duty to be exercise good faith in the contract's formation.
Could I ask one other question?
Yes, sir.
If we didn't have any June 1 contract, if we didn't have any new contract, what would have been the duties for Mr. Taylor on those two conversations in April? Would they have been tort duties or contract duties? Or you wanted him to be more forthcoming. What does that duty spring from?
I think the duties are tort duties because the obligation to tell the truth in whatever context has been found by this court and for years has been found to be an important public policy decision. So I think that independent of whether there was a contract, whether there would be a contract, he had an independent duty under tort to tell the truth, not to conceal information, and not to lie to us.
Mrs. Bradley?
Thank you. Independent duty to tell the truth sounds like that's painting with a pretty broad brush. Am I negligent if I fail to tell the truth? Is that what you're talking about? Or are you talking about intentional misrepresentation?
I'm talking about intentional misrepresentation. I think it's pretty clear that the economic loss doctrine has been extended. The pendulum has swung. We don't have a negligent misrepresentation standard that's surviving the economic loss doctrine, and probably not strict either. But the court, not this court, but the appellate courts, have carved out an exception for the intentional misrepresentation, which requires a whole host of elements very difficult to meet. There's a middle burden of proof. There's in the jury instructions, instructions on what is and is not a misrepresentation. You know, an opinion is not representation such that it would be actionable. So there are a whole number of safeguards that would not allow this intentional misrepresentation tort to grow beyond its appropriate means. It's already been recognized in Wisconsin for going on 100 years.
But to get back to Justice Prosser's question, which I don't think has been answered yet, if there were no June 1st, 1996 contract, what would your claim be?
Our claim would be that Taylor made a representation of fact, that it was untrue. He knew it was untrue. He did it with an intent to deceive and to induce us to act, which is to allow the Krinsky relationship to go forward, and that caused us damages. If you are supposing that it would have gone, that Ameritech terminated our distributorship.
Could I ask,
Justice Prosser?
On the top of page 7 of the Ameritech brief is what Mr. Taylor is supposed to have said. He's not in my territory. He does not. He did not work in my territory. So I would have to check that out for you.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm perfectly prepared to accept that Taylor knew a lot more than that. But did he do anything more than say that? I mean, saying that, is that that's an affirmative a misrepresentation?
Well, it's clearly an omission when you are asked, what do you know about Mr. Taylor, and you have that statement. So it's certainly an omission that would be actionable under such cases as Allerman. But we don't have him saying anything more than that. However, those statements preceded the April 30 letter, which he knew because Ray Taylor authored it, put our distributorship at risk. He also knew, because he's the one who presented the June 1st contract, that the effect of his representation was to put our distributorship at risk. And I think that that type of conduct was considered by the jury, including his attempts at covering up that his prior knowledge, in awarding punitive damages.
Counsel, I have one quick question.
Yes.
As you know, in Douglas Hanson, the Court of Appeals adopted a broad exception, and three members of this court would have reversed that without giving reasons, therefore. What would you suggest to these three members, or at least to me, as to why we were either wrong or why Douglas Hanson could forget why we were wrong?
How we can be better.
How we can do better. Can you distinguish Douglas Hanson?
I think we can. Douglas Hanson involved, as I recall, an adhesive product where the representation pre-contract was that it was market-tested, ready to go. Those may not be exactly the words, but that's what we're talking about. That type of representation concerns the quality and character of goods, and it is that type of representation that is addressed in Huron Tool, where Huron Tool says normally fraud will not be accepted, but where it's a representation for the quality and character of goods, then the economic loss doctrine will apply. And I think that is the distinction here, that the Douglas Hanson decision, where three justices did not find that
three
there was
justices were right and three were wrong, but we don't know who, right?
Right. I think I remember. But in any event, I think it comes closer to the Huron Tool exception than our case does, where the telephone services that are at issue among this whole distributor agreement is not the heart of the agreement.
Didn't the Court of Appeals rely heavily on the Douglas Hanson case in reaching the decision they reached here to affirm? Did they draw any distinction between the rule in Douglas Hanson and the rule that they adopted in this case?
I don't know that the Court of Appeals made that distinction, because at that time it was uniform in the Court of Appeals decisions that there was an absolute bar. In other words, that if there's fraud in the inducement, fraud in the inducement claims are accepted from the economic loss doctrine. So they really didn't deal with the other authority that's out there in our Seventh Circuit, although there's a split of authority there, and Florida. They typically went with the prevailing understanding that the Court of Appeals decisions had put forward. And some of those, like the Kalin case, which is a Court of Appeals, actually came down after our case, which also reaffirmed that principle.
Another way of saying that is that they adopted a very broad exception to the economic loss doctrine, not a narrow one. Isn't that correct?
That's one way of putting it. The other way of putting it, where the Waddell brief says, is that it's been framed as, is it an exception? It could also be seen as they were not willing to apply the economic loss doctrine to areas where typically it had never been thought to apply. So I guess it's the other side of the coin, but you are correct.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Cook, at last. They have eaten substantially into your time, counsel. You have 30 seconds.
30 seconds. That's what I
usually have to say hello.
10 minutes, counsel.
Well, Your Honor, I really do feel like I'm the tail wagging the dog here in light of the factual situations that have come up. It is true that Mr. Krinsky was hired by our company. He wasn't hired long before, I think, as counsel represented. He was hired, I think, in March. And in April, the agreement between DigiCorp and Bakker was put into place. The important thing about Mr. Krinsky was that he was working for an Ameritech distributor across town in Green Bay, a bigger company than our small company, and came to our company and said, we've made money selling value link plans before at other company. Maybe we can try and link up with an authorized distributor and sell value link plans with you. And that's what formed the basis of this agreement. That's why we feel as strongly as DigiCorp does that the misrepresentation was extraneous to the contract here, because there was nothing wrong with these value link plans that were put in place. Everybody who Mr. Krinsky fraudulently put in place with a value link plan got exactly what that value link plan offered them. And the whole portion of the case that was addressed during the trial was that Ameritech needed to create a market and tie up the market, because these value link plans were either 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, or 5 year plans. And once a person was locked into a intra-LATA or long-distance calling plan that Ameritech was allowed to compete in the marketplace with, every other competitor couldn't get to them. And we argued very strongly that the reason Ray Taylor lied about Krinsky's past, lied about the fact that he was told to investigate Krinsky a year before, and lied about the fact that he tried to cover it up when it was disclosed, was because he gained a monetary advantage to this as well. Part of his pay did come from these sales. And so that when this lie was engendered and these parties entered into this contract, and then the fraud was discovered, the only person that ever reported it was Bakker. Bakker was the one who went to the sheriff's department. The sheriff was the one who did the investigation, and it was the testimony of the sheriff of several key Ameritech employees that showed that they were incensed that Ray Taylor had not revealed this information, because for a year they had been complaining to Taylor that Krinsky had been submitting forged contracts, and it may have been submitted as many as 400 when he was at the other company. And the problem, then, I think, in looking at these cases is when you look at the economic loss doctrine, basically the doctrine started out by saying in a product case where the only damage is to the product itself, and now, of course, we could say to the service itself, then why get involved in tort? Why not stick with the contract remedies? Because nobody else has been injured. Tort is meant to compensate people for personal injury or property damage or damage to their business reputation or something of that nature. Why not make a distinction? And that really, I think, is when those cases came down initially. Being a tort lawyer, it took me a while to read that case and to pound it into my head and understand that the court was making a distinction between contract and tort. But here, the basis of our case isn't that there was anything wrong with the ValueLink calling plans. The basis of our case was the misrepresentation. This was clearly a fraud in the inducement case. This was clearly a misrepresentation case. And I think, regardless of whether there was a contract on June 1st that was entered into, there would have been a cause of action here. Because what happened was Ameritech used the very wrongful conduct of Taylor to terminate the agreement. And in the amicus brief, as well as the other cases that we cited, when there is fraud in the inducement, the party's right to remedy is to void the contract and then seek damages for loss of profits, just like they did in Douglas Hanson and in other cases. And that is the basis for the case. That's why you need an exception in a fraudulent inducement case.
That's not what was done here, though. There was a recovery of both breach of contract damages and fraud damages.
Well, I know you asked that question about how the damages were measured. The way the presentation of the case came in, the experts, I think all sides had economic experts that proved up what the losses were. I know that DigiCorp brought in someone to prove what they would have earned had the distributorship not been terminated. And then, of course, there were punitive damages that were awarded.
For what period of time?
For a period of time that the jury was allowed to, I think, the instruction on breach of contract was only for 30 days, but for the lost profits and expectations, the same instruction there was probably the same one that was given in the Douglas Hanson case. In other words, what did the jury believe would be the reasonable expectation of the period of time that these damages would be awarded?
No outer limit?
There was no outer limit. There was no outer limit because the DigiCorp established that they had had an Ameritech distributorship for a number of years, even under a previous name of a company, I think, called Barch Communications.
And the evidence was that none of these contracts, either the June 1st one or the predecessor contracts, had expiration dates?
No, there was an expiration date that was proven up in the June 1st contract and established that they, from time to time, these contracts were renewed. No question about that. Plus the limitation that the contracts could be terminated on 30 days' notice. And based upon that, Judge Griesbach limited the contract damages to just the 30 days.
To go back to my question, though, it is true that in this case, breach of contract damages and tort damages for fraud were recovered.
They were submitted to the jury, but then on motions after, and then, of course, in the Court of Appeals decision, the breach of contract damages fell away. And so it was basically a tort case.
What was your client's detrimental reliance?
Well, my client's detrimental reliance was based upon, and if you look at the jury verdict, the fact that I think there was a restatement of tort instruction that was made as well that said that if a party has the right to reasonably rely upon information that would normally have been transmitted to them, and if you can see one of the questions on the verdict asked whether or not any representations were made to us directly, The jury answered that no, even though we presented testimony of a woman named Diane McKee, who was the distributor in the Green Bay area. But then they said, did we have a right to rely? That's where our reliance came, and that instruction was fashioned by the court.
What evidence was there of your client's detrimental reliance? Not whether they had a right to rely because there was an expectation that this misrepresentation would be communicated, but what was the act of reliance?
Of our reliance?
Yes.
Our reliance was that when Mr. Clark had asked about Krinsky's information, none of that information, obviously, he didn't relay anything to us that was negative and did not relay anything to us that was positive either.
What did your client do in reliance on that?
What did our client do in reliance on
the failure to disclose?
Well, we continued forward with the agreement. Our people testified that had they known about Krinsky, they would never have gone forward with this. He probably would have been terminated.
He was already on the payroll.
Yes, I know, but he had not placed all these fraudulent contracts into evidence. Counsel had represented that, yes, he had long since put these fraudulent contracts into evidence. The evidence would suggest that most of the contracts were placed in May and June, just prior to the time that he left, that he did not start fraudulently entering into these contracts until sometime after he was employed by us and after the system was put into place. So that early on in these initial negotiations, had we known that Krinsky had this prior criminal behavior in his past at NCS Communications, we would not have gone, not only would we have not gone forward with DigiCorp because they would have backed out, but we would have probably terminated Krinsky. And there was testimony to that extent by our people.
Didn't the jury find that your client was negligent in regard to hiring and supervising Mr. Krinsky?
They did. They did. And that was a distinction that we discussed before, I think, that in intentional tort cases, of course, the jury, there was enough evidence to submit for this because we didn't know how the jury was going to decide this. But once the jury found fraud in the inducement, any contributory negligence with regard to negligent hiring, supervision, et cetera, would have fallen through. We were found 40% at fault. Ameritech was found 60% at fault. So their claim against us, even if it would have been allowed to stand without the intentional tort, would have fallen as well because they were more at fault in the negligent hiring and supervision aspect of the case than we were. So they were not awarded any damages for that. I think the jury awarded $5,000 in damages for that on the negligent hiring and supervision, but that was never that would never have stood even absent the finding of intentional tort.
Mr. Cook, I've got another question. My understanding is that you argued and the Court of Appeals agreed with you that the economic loss doctrine didn't apply to your client because there was no privity.
That's
now,
right.
That seems to be totally contrary to language from the Danan and Jansen case, where the majority indicated that privity didn't make any difference, that the economic loss doctrine applied in certain situations absent privity. How do you explain that?
Well, I agree with the Danan decision, and I think that if that issue was up before us here, that would be something that we'd have to address. But what I would say is this. I agree with the Danan decision. I don't think you'd necessarily need it without privity, but we pled a breach of contract claim that was dismissed. We had no other recourse, Your Honor. We have no other recourse in this case other than for tort. And it's as simple as that. That is the fact. And, of course, there was no relationship that we had with Ameritech because we were the subagent under our relationship with DigiCorp.
Where does this nice round number of $100,000 damages come from?
Well, the evidence proved up the following. There was the amount of money that was paid to Krinsky for his salary. There was the amount of profits that we would have been entitled to from Ameritech, which they cut off and did not pay us. There were amount of profits that we were entitled to for otherwise legitimate contracts that were not paid to us. We asserted a claim because we were wrongfully sued initially by DigiCorp. So we submitted a claim for our attorney's fees incurred in defending that case. And Finally, there was testimony of damage to our business reputation. Those numbers, interestingly, added up to something like $99,990.10.
Come on.
They did. I am telling you, you can check the record. And so the award for $100,000 was exactly what we put into evidence. Now, the expert said that the damage to business reputation was conservative. And he gave his calculations as to why he felt it was this amount.
So the jury gave you 90 cents more.
90 cents more. And the reason was because Bacher was the company whose name was in the paper up there throughout in the Green Bay area. They were the ones who looked bad throughout the whole matter in this case. And by the time we presented the case to the jury, they agreed that we did suffer some damage. But those amounts were all proven up solidly with the numbers.
No further questions. Thank you, Mr. Thank you. Cook. Mr. Apfel, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. If I could attempt to address some questions and comments that have arisen during the course of the last presentations. First, I think that there was one question was asked, if there were no June 1st, 1996 contract, what would the remedy be? I think that the answer is abundantly clear. The remedy would have been a cause of action in contract for breach of good faith and fair dealing, because if the obligation, implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing means anything, it means being honesty in fact. There would have been a cause of action. Now, let's look again at the supposed reliance, the supposed inducement.
Before you go there, just yes. To go back to the last point, and what is the state of the law in Wisconsin on contract remedies for breach of the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing? We have such a thing here, don't we?
Yes, we do. I suppose that, I will assume. You mean we have a cause of action? Yes, I believe that we do. It would be the damages that proximately flow from the breach. And if you look here, I would submit that under the uncontested facts, even as construed in their favor, there are precious few damages. Mr. Cook, for example, goes on and said, well, the majority of the fraud, the forged signatures, took place after the alleged misrepresentation on the part of Mr. Taylor. Well, that's probably true. Probably the majority of the forgeries did take place. But a whole passel of them took place before then. Mr. Krinsky was hired. This whole thing was set up. And he was off and running without any supervision on the part of either Bacher or DigiCorp long before the alleged misrepresentation.
That's a nice segue into your reliance point.
Yeah, that's correct. Thank you, Your Honor.
So you can go back to that.
Now let's look at that alleged misrepresentation. Says Ray Taylor to Mr. Clark. What do I know about Mr. Krinsky? He wasn't in my territory. True. I don't know anything. We assume false. I'll check on it for you. How do you reasonably rely upon an expression of ignorance by someone who is in no position to know? You can't. The only thing they could have relied on here is his statement, I will check, which, as I noted before, is absolutely inseparably bound up with the certification and approval requirements that were described orally by him and ultimately confirmed in writing. And what are those? It's a promise. It's a promise.
What's a promise?
To certify and approve. And they say they breached it in bad faith.
I'm sorry, and they say what?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm speaking too quickly. The statement that I'll check up on it, mm-hmm. which is bound up with the certification and approval representations and provisions, if it was false, it is in the nature of a fraud in the performance, not in the inducement of a contract.
You know, that the reason I hear the word promise, you said, you know,
yes.
The fraud and the promise, because this case smells to me of promissory estoppel, not exactly, but in theory. You mentioned the idea of, look, if there's no contract, then you have a breach of good faith and fair dealing, which is the same kind of cause of action that you see in a lot of relationships where the underlying relationship is contractual, but instead there's a promissory estoppel theory which allows for greater damages, including what's traditionally tort damages. How do you distinguish that kind of thing from here? I know this is not pled as promissory estoppel, but you mentioned the most you have is a promise here, yeah. And boy, that brings promissory estoppel to me, which is this blend, just yeah. like this is.
Actually, I will answer your question, Your Honor, but I would note when I say promise, I believe that it would be a contractual type of promise. I don't think that they would have had to rely on promissory estoppel. But promissory estoppel, I would actually beg to differ with Your Honor's characterization of the remedies available for promissory estoppel. I think that it is the exceptional case in which expectation damages are granted. Now, it's possible. It is possible. I think that you have to look at the ultimate roots of the cause of action for promissory estoppel, which originally was designed to satisfy a void in consideration on the part of the promisee. Now, the doctrine has expanded beyond that, but that is the root of it. But I think that if you look, you know, not only at Hoffman versus Red Owl, but a number of the subsequent expressions of this Court and the Court of Appeals, and forgive me, they don't come to mind. One of them had to do with Alpine Valley, I think, was a party. I think that while expectation damages are available, they are not a matter of course. But that is a quasi-contractual and not a tort remedy. Again, I think that that we need to look at contract law here and not a tort law.
Speaking of doctrines that have expanded beyond their original roots, the sort of misrepresentation we have here is not an affirmative misrepresentation, but an omission.
That's correct.
Which only lies if there's a duty to speak.
That's right.
And it's that doctrine is traceable to Allerman, correct?
I think in Wisconsin, yes. I think you can trace it to Allerman. Interestingly, if you read Allerman, you will find that Allerman is basing its expanded tort duties on what it perceives to be changes in business practices, that is, in the standards of good faith and fair dealing, you know, that creates what now creates a cause of action in contract. So there is no need, and no, it's not appropriate to rely on tort damages here.
Well, and isn't the language of that case limited to essentially non-commercial settings where you don't necessarily have arm's-length bargaining? You have one party in possession of facts which are material to the transaction, and the other party who is not in a position to readily ascertain those facts by his or her own due diligence.
I think that's a fair characterization. In this, I'm sure that my opponents would say, well, you knew these facts about Krinsky at NCS, and we could not possibly have known them. I would disagree, first, with that premise that they could not possibly have known it, because they themselves, the Bachers, worked at NCS. And they left precisely because they felt it was a hotbed of unethical and fraudulent activity, and yet they asked Krinsky no questions when he comes to them with this scheme of his to ride coattails on DigiCorp. But even assuming we had this knowledge unavailable to them, the fact of the matter is it's a snapshot. It's a little snapshot. Do I rely? I tried to put this in a perspective that we can understand. If my law firm went out and hired a new lawyer, the new lawyer comes with a certification. It's a certification from a law school that new lawyer is competent and someone of integrity. Do I put that new lawyer in an office and leave him or her alone for 3.5 months without checking? And yet that's exactly what happened here. The use of a tort has allowed them to escape their own responsibility. And I believe that we have outlined 5 different reasons why that result should not obtain there. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Apple. Thank you, Counsel. Very good presentation. That ends the oral argument in case number 1833 and 225801. We will... call the next case, and we will meet. And meanwhile, if the clerk would please contact the Chief Justice, I believe she is participating in this case.